Thank you. Well, I'm very happy to be here to discuss this important subject with all of you. I was trying to think about how to get into this subject and develop this talk, and I thought maybe I could just boil the whole thing down to a really great line from a not very good movie. The movie is called The Big Bounce. I don't know if any of you have seen it, but this is not a very good movie, a crime caper movie, you know, with this con men, and they're all trying to outsmart each other. And at one point, one of the characters played by Owen Wilson, you may know him, he's a guy with blonde hair and sort of a funny nose. And he's talking to a character played by Morgan Freeman, who's a corrupt judge in Hawaii where the movie takes place. And they're discussing how to run a con, and at a certain point, Owen Wilson's character says, "Yeah, but what about all these problems we're going to run into? How are we going to deal with that?" And Morgan Freeman says, "Well, we just have to have faith." And Owen Wilson says, "You mean like in God?" And Morgan Freeman's character says the great line, "God is just an imaginary friend for grown-ups." So I thought maybe I could just begin and end with that. But we know it's more complicated than that and more serious. So we do need to dig into this whole thing a lot more deeply. To get into it, let me tell another story about a comrade of ours who went to a museum where they had an exhibit about Mexico in ancient and modern times. And first you go through and you see some of the ancient peoples who lived in Mexico, the Olmecs and others, and then you come to the period of the Aztecs several hundred years ago, and there are all these exhibits of the Aztecs, the artifacts, you know, the pottery and other things from their civilization, and some of the religious things they used in their religious ceremonies. So you get a whole display about the Aztec religion. And then at a certain point, there's this gigantic cross in the middle of the exhibit. And this signifies the time when the Spanish conquistadores came in and conquered Mexico, and along with doing that, imposed the Christian religion on the people there and brutally repressed and killed people who tried to continue the old religious ways. And this comrade was going through this exhibit with his mother, who grew up in Mexico but moved to the U.S. when she was young, and is a very devout Catholic, or was a very devout Catholic. So when they went through this whole Aztec exhibit, and then they got to the big cross, and then everything after that was an exhibit of Christianity in Mexico, he said to her, "See, Ma," pointing to the Aztec side, "if those people had won instead of these other people, the Spanish, you'd be worshiping those gods instead of this one." And this gets to something very deep. Why do people believe in the religion they do? Why do they believe in the God or gods they do? Why do they practice religion the way they do? Does it really have to do with supernatural things that have been handed down to people? Or does it have to do with very earthly things, like the conquest and invasion and occupation of Mexico by the Spanish, who then forced the people there to take up this new religion? So that now someone like his mother, generations and centuries later, doesn't know that that's why she worships the Christian God, because that's all in the past hidden from her, and she's just come to accept this as the way that it is because the Bible tells her so. But let's look at this from a different angle. The Christian cross, which the Spanish brought with them, has been very much in the news and the culture lately because there's been this whole movie by Mel Gibson, The Passion of the Christ, the whole crucifixion of Jesus with the cross as the symbol, on and on with the blood and everything else. But here's a question we're thinking about. Why is the cross associated with Jesus a big symbol in this society, and the crucifixion of Jesus a big symbol in this society, but the crucifixion of Spartacus not a big symbol in this society, not a big fact in this society? In fact, many people, maybe some of you here, don't know who I'm referring to when I talk about Spartacus. Spartacus was a slave who led a rebellion of slaves in the Roman Empire less than a century, about 80 years before Jesus, that threatened the Roman Empire to its foundations before it was finally drowned in blood. And as a result of its being defeated, Spartacus and all of his followers were crucified on crosses, lining the main road from Rome out to the provinces for miles and miles and miles. Why is that cross and that crucifixion not a big symbol in our society? And why is it in most, why is it not in most of the societies in the world today? The answer is simple and basic. Because what is represented by Spartacus, even in his defeat, that is the slaves rising up, is not something the ruling classes of the societies we live in and the ruling classes that we live under want to promote. Yes, a movie got made about Spartacus, but that's nothing compared to the continual barrage of propaganda about Jesus and the life of Jesus and the crucifixion of Jesus. Because again, the people who rule over us don't want us to have symbols that call to mind slaves rising up in rebellion. They want us to believe that such rebellions are pointless and that we are bound to and have to live the way we live because that's the way God wants it to be. That's the way God made the world, and all you can do is accept God's will. Or let's look at another example. There's a sect of the Jewish religion centered in New York called the Lubavitchers. They're fundamentalist Jews. The head of their sect until 1994 was a man named Rabbi Menachem Schneerson. As you know, the Jews don't accept that Jesus was the Messiah, but the followers of Rabbi Schneerson, or many of them, started believing that he was the Messiah that was predicted in the old Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament of the Bible. And they began promoting this idea, and it actually got to very humorous and ridiculous lengths. A sort of an illustration of the combination of very modern technology with very backward Dark Ages ideas. They were all getting their cell phones and their pagers out as he was approaching his death, waiting to find out if Rabbi Schneerson was going to finally announce that he was, after all, the Messiah. So here we have this really ridiculous and strange scene where all these people practicing all this medieval religion, carrying around these modern technology to get the word, is the rabbi going to tell us he's the Messiah after all? And then he died without ever giving the word. Or you have the Rastafarians in Jamaica and other places, who actually believe that Haile Selassie, also known as Rastafari, was actually the Messiah come back. I saw a movie about Bob Marley where this woman in Jamaica was talking about she actually saw, when Haile Selassie came to Jamaica, she believed she actually saw the stigmata, the wounds from the nails driven into Jesus' hands. She actually saw them, she believed, in Haile Selassie's hands. Well, in reality, they weren't there. But this is what the Rastafarians believe, that this person, Haile Selassie, who was actually a brutal oppressor of the people of Ethiopia and a pawn and instrument of imperialist rule in Africa, was somehow the savior and messiah of the people. You know, there's kind of an irony, you know, that Bob Marley song, Redemption Songs, where he says at one point, he sings at one point, "Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds." And yet, this is just another form of mental slavery, this Rastafarianism. But what if somehow the world turned, and a couple of decades or a century or more from now, somehow Africa emerged as the continent of the most developed imperialist powers, and somehow the people in Africa there actually held up Haile Selassie as the real Messiah? Then people all over the world who were conquered by them would be worshiping Haile Selassie as the Messiah, and they'd all be seeing the stigmata that were in his hands, even though he's long dead. Or take the Mormons. Everybody's laughing because I always like to talk about the Mormons, but they're good for illustrating a lot of things. Now, the Mormons believe that 500 years before Jesus, if you read the Book of Mormon, you'll see this, 500 years before Jesus, an offshoot of the Jewish people left and somehow got across the seas over to America. And there was this whole history of peoples in America battling each other, and some of them were, you know, on the side of God, and then not on the side of God, and back and forth they went. And then at some point, Jesus actually appeared to the Latter-day Saints of the Mormon religion and told them all the things that are, you know, that he would do when he rose. And this is all in the Book of Mormon. Well, obviously this is in very sharp conflict with traditional Christianity. And in fact, it's in greater conflict with reality. Because there were no such tribes of people in the Americas. There were Native Americans, but not the ones they're talking about in the Book of Mormon. There's absolutely no evidence that these people ever existed or did anything here. And you have Mormon so-called archaeologists desperately digging around all over the place trying to find evidence of this, and they can't find any that ever stands up. But you know, the Mormons, one thing interesting about the Mormons is a lot of Mormons in the FBI. Because it's a very conservative, straight, obedient to authority kind of religion, and it lends itself very well to doing something like being in the FBI or the CIA. And Mormonism, all the Mormons have to go on a 2-year mission at a certain point in their lives. Mormonism is a very rapidly expanding religion. Well, just suppose that for the whatever the interests of the ruling class in the society happened to be, they decided that it would be good to have Mormons running the whole state. Then we'd all have to believe all this stuff in the Book of Mormon, and children growing up would think it was just as natural as they now think it is to believe in Jesus as the Messiah and all the myths that are in the Bible. And we could go on and on like this. And I'll keep coming back to this point because it's an essential point to get into, that people believe these things and assume they're true. Because this has been, they've been indoctrinated with this, it's been ingrained into their mind. All the workings of society that they're in work to reinforce the idea that this is the truth. And then you grow up within it just assuming that this is the way the world is. And if you're in another part of the world, you don't believe Jesus is the Messiah, you believe he was a prophet, and that Muhammad was the last prophet, and Islam is the true religion. And I'll come back to that point a little bit more later. So down beneath all this is a deeper question that a lot of people wrestle with and agonize over. Can human beings be good without God? Is there a human need for God? Can there be a meaning to life and to human existence without God? Religion in general and Christianity in particular on the one hand and communism on the other hand give very different answers to these questions. And one of these answers is real and has to do with the real world, and the other is not and does not. So to get into this more fully, let's step back a little bit and get a broader picture from history. Throughout the world, people in ancient societies and people without a scientific approach to studying, to engaging, and to changing reality, people who have not yet developed or who have been denied access to such a scientific approach, or people who have resisted and rejected such a scientific approach, these people have brought forth and rallied around various myths in the attempt to develop a meaningful story of how they came to be, of the reality they experienced, of the larger reality they perceived outside themselves, and of how they wish reality to be. They have treated these myths as the defining element of reality. For example, the story of creation, as it's called in Genesis in the Bible, is nothing but the origin myth of the ancient Jewish people. It doesn't correspond to reality. It's not borne out by what science has taught us about how the earth and the heavens, so-called the stars, the galaxies, actually developed and in what order. The earth is not the center of all this, and the stars and everything else were not put there for the benefit of man on the earth. But many of these stars have existed long before the earth came into being. Some of them have even existed and gone out of existence in the period before the earth actually came into being, and before human beings, several million, billion years rather, later, came into being. And there are many things that are historically inaccurate, besides proven to be wrong by science, in this creation story in Genesis. And this is not unique. Every people in the world have a myth that is their attempt, usually going back hundreds or even thousands of years, to explain things like where they came from and how they relate to the rest of reality. We had a series of articles in our newspaper, The Revolutionary Worker, on evolution. And in one of the early articles in that series, we had a box in the paper illustrating the different creation myths of different people around the world, including the early Jewish origin myth that's in the Bible. Some people believe that they were formed in the earth and then rose up to the surface of the earth. Some people believe they were formed in the sky and then fell down to earth. Some people believe the whole existence that we know is just the back of a giant turtle. Now, when we hear these things, we're tempted to laugh at everybody else's creation myths. Because we're taught that ours is the one that's true, but if you step back from it, this one is no less silly than all the others. And no less disproven by the reality of what's happened in the history of humanity and the history of the natural world. So what we learn from this is that in actuality, these stories were not and are not a true description of realities. They are not a true description of nature, of a development of human beings, and of particular peoples and their relation to the rest of humanity and to the natural universe. They were not and are not timeless and enduring truths handed down or inspired by some supernatural beings, gods, or by one all-knowing, all-powerful, supreme being, God the Almighty, who surpasses all human existence and knowledge while ruling the entire universe in some mysterious way that none of us can understand. Religious stories and scriptures were and are precisely rooted in myths, fanciful products of the human imagination, attempts to explain things which people could not accurately, rationally, and scientifically understand and explain to others at the time. In this connection, it's worth thinking about a very interesting fact. The majority of scientists, people who practice science as their profession, the majority of them who have ever existed in the world are alive now. And what this reflects is the fact that for the great, great part of human history, there was very little scientific knowledge and very little people who were investigating reality from a scientific standpoint. This is a very recent thing. And that's why all these myths grew up and became so much fastened to people's minds. But it's more than that. The explanations that religion attempts to provide for seemingly mysterious aspects of reality and for the larger and defining principles of reality, these explanations are not just wrong in some neutral sense. They are not harmless. They do a great deal of harm and cause a great deal of anguish and suffering. Let's look at some examples from Christianity and the Judeo-Christian tradition. Today we know, as a result of scientific advancement, that epilepsy, when people go into fits and so on, is a product of problems in the chemistry and electrical workings of their brain. And that's something that comes, it lasts for a while, and it passes. And then they come back to, you know, a quote-unquote normal state of being. But for most of the existence of humanity, people thought things like epilepsy were a sign of something terrible. That people were possessed by the devil or demons, and people suffered terribly as a result of this ignorance. Well, this ignorance is put forward right in the Bible. How does Jesus cure epileptics? Well, if you read, for example, Matthew chapter 17, verses 14 to 20, you will see Jesus curing an epileptic supposedly by casting out demons. Now, we know now that epilepsy has nothing to do with demons whatsoever. But people in that time, including Jesus, did not know that. Or look at the story of the creation in Genesis once again. What is the story? Well, this fanciful notion of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, knowing no guilt or innocence, no sin, having no knowledge of good and evil because it was just all good. And somehow Eve got tempted by this serpent, ate the one fruit they were forbidden to eat, the apple, and then seduced Adam into eating it, and it all went downhill from there. So then we have the fall of man, which is the reason why we have to have Jesus come back with a resurrection in order to save mankind from its fallen condition. So we see humanity already, through this mythology, cast in the position of being a damned and a failed species that can only cause tremendous havoc and harm on its own. And within this we see, not surprisingly given the kind of societies that have existed for thousands of years, we see a special curse upon women. If you read Genesis, for example, the story of the weakness and treachery of Eve in the Garden of Eden, if you read, for example, Genesis chapter 3, especially verses 14 to 16, you'll see how because of Eve's supposedly treacherous role in the Garden of Eden and bringing about the downfall of mankind, childbirth is to become a curse on all women thereafter. Every woman who suffers pain in childbirth, according to Christianity and the Judeo-Christian tradition, suffers it because of the sin of Eve. Not because of very real material and medical factors that we all know a lot about nowadays, but supposedly because of the sin and treachery and seductive nature of Eve. Listen to this. Hey, I brought my Bible. Listen to Genesis 3:16. This is the curse put upon women. To the women, he said, this is the Lord speaking, I will greatly increase your pangs in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. All because of Eve's supposed conduct in the Garden of Eden. So these stories are not harmless. They do a great deal of harm and have down through centuries. And this curse upon women, including in childbirth, is not just something of the Old Testament. It's also upheld in the New Testament by Paul. For example, if you look at 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 8 to 15, you'll see him repeating this curse upon women. Or let's take the story of Noah's Ark. Well, I have sad news. It never happened. There is absolutely no historical evidence of any kind, from anthropology, from archaeology, from any kind of historical investigation, that suggests that any kind of a flood like this covered the whole earth for 40 days and 40 nights. Sure, there were local floods in the area of Mesopotamia, like what's now mainly Iraq, very often, because there are a lot of, you know, there are rivers there, and they flood from time to time, just like the Mississippi or other rivers do here. But there never has been any evidence, and never even any account outside of the Bible, of a flood that covered the whole earth, which supposedly was the basis for the whole story of Noah's Ark and for humanity starting all over again. Because God was displeased with what mankind had done. If such a flood had occurred, it surely would have affected civilizations that existed at that time all over the world. It surely would have left its mark, both in terms of the actual structures and buildings of those societies, and also in terms of disrupting the whole nature of those civilizations. Yet you can go from the historical records and the archaeological records from one part of the world to another, and there is absolutely no evidence of this ever having occurred. So once again, this is mythology. And it's one thing when people make up mythology, especially when they don't have a basis to know any better. But upholding this now, and especially upholding it as literally true, is to uphold and promote superstition and ignorance of how the world really is and how it has developed and changed throughout its real history. And it is to promote all the suffering that goes along with and is reinforced by this superstition and ignorance. It is not harmless. It does a great deal of harm. It keeps people mentally enslaved and unable to face reality and change reality according to how it actually is. These fables and other similar stories in the Bible were part of what came to be crystallized and set down in writing as the ancient Jewish scriptures, or the Old Testament of the Christian Bible. But these scriptures were not just the embodiment of different myths and attempts to explain reality in the abstract, or without any social content or impact on society. They were and are the reflection of the human societies in which these myths arose. And they are a reflection of the relations in those societies between different people, as well as the relations between those societies and other societies, and a reflection of all the ideas that go along with and reinforce these relations. And I'll keep coming back to and illustrating this point as we go along. But a key point here is, once relations of exploitation and oppression arose, relations of domination of the means to live and of political power and intellectual life by a small group or class of people. Once this arose in human society, religion has been used by the ruling classes to enforce and extend these relations of exploitation and oppression and the system that embodies them. As a leaflet put out by our party on the movie The Passion of the Christ summarizes it, not only is the Bible not literally true, it is a book full of what can charitably be described as a hodgepodge of remarkably violent legends, tall tales, and tribal history, interspersed with a little lyric poetry, a lot of revenge-filled fantastical rants, and some origin myths. And these were all told and then set down in writing in order to reinforce first a male-dominated society in the desert based on agriculture several thousand years ago, then a slave empire in Rome, and then an oppressive feudal society of landlords and serfs and peasants in Europe. The Bible is filled with codes of behavior that are either hypocritical or openly and brutally oppressive. Now this same ancient stuff is being adapted to reinforce the capitalist oppression of today in a $25 million cleverly promoted Hollywood film, The Passion of the Christ. We don't need this. But there are people who do, the people who rule a society. Napoleon, who a couple of centuries ago became the ruler of France, spoke to why the ruling classes who exploit and oppress people need religion and need to promote it among the masses of people. And this is what he said very simply. Society is impossible without inequality. Inequality cannot be sustained without a morality to justify it. And morality, in turn, cannot be sustained without religion. You can't say he's not pretty straight up. And there's value in that. Or there is a scene, a very instructive scene from the movie Spartacus, where a couple of ruling class members, members of the ruling Senate in Rome, are talking about this very question of the populace and how to keep them under control and the role of religion in this. And one of these Roman senators says to another, "Well, don't you actually believe in the gods?" And the other senator said something really worth paying attention to. He says, "Privately, I believe in none of them. Publicly, I believe in them all." And that speaks to the same point that Napoleon was making. Well, then there's that motherfucker, Ronald Reagan, who we've been asked to honor, you know, this great leader for, you know, a whole nauseous period of time here. And I have to take a minute to say a few things about Ronald Reagan. It wouldn't be appropriate not to do it. This is a man who's been repackaged as this kindly figure, you know, brought about peace in the world. But the reality is, this is a man who took us to the brink of nuclear war with the Soviet Union. You know, one time he gave a speech and he made a joke before the speech began. "We begin bombing in 5 minutes. Ha, ha, ha." Now think about what kind of person and what kind of ruling class thinks that's a funny joke, joking about the start of nuclear war. And he did take us to the brink, and he was willing to push it over the brink in order to make sure that the U.S. and not the Soviet Union came out as the dominant world power. Or look what he did in Central America, this kindly uncle of ours. In one country after another, brutal military dictatorships were imposed on the people at the cost of tremendous suffering and brutality. I wrote this book called Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That? And I talked about how, for example, in Guatemala, one after another, these military dictatorships would send the army out to slaughter the people in villages where rebels were rising up against the government. And in particular, there was one that I pointed to, Rios Montt, who was a born-again Christian busher. And people like not only Reagan, but Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson got on TV and so on and openly prayed for God to give support and help to Rios Montt. And what did the army do under Rios Montt and these other dictators? As I point out in that book, they would go into villages around where they thought the guerrillas might be rebelling, They would round up all the people, slaughter all the males from teenage up through anyone of fighting age, rape all the women, and then take the little babies down by the river or somewhere away from the village and smash all their heads in so that they couldn't grow up to oppose the government. And this is not, I am not exaggerating any of this. This went on time and time again. Perhaps Rios Montt, that born-again butcher, was inspired from the many places in the Bible where it calls for bashing in the heads of babies. And I'll come back to that a little later. And then we've heard recently, for example, in recent years, about the terrible killing that went on in Rwanda. And all these imperialist politicians wringing their hands. Well, why didn't we do anything to stop this slaughter in Rwanda? All these African people slaughtering each other back and forth. Well, that was a terrible thing, and the imperialists actually had a hand in instigating that, by the way. But that lasted for a relatively short period of time. It was this wild sort of spasm of violence that did kill and maim and torture hundreds of thousands of people. But just a decade earlier, under the kindly, peace-loving Ronald Reagan, there was an organization, just as these Guatemalan governments were backed and financed by the U.S., there was an organization organized and financed by the U.S. called RENAMO that not for a few months, but over a period of years, systematically carried out the most grotesque brutality and slaughter of people that's imaginable. They would kill and maim people, then they would go into the hospitals where people were being treated, and they would kill and maim some more. Not once, but over and over and over again. And all this was organized and funded by the CIA and the U.S. government under the kindly Ronald Reagan. Fuck Ronald Reagan. And here's the thing, it's a smaller thing, but has a big lesson in it. This man, the reason I'm raising Ronald Reagan, besides the fact that I have to say a few things about him anyway, is the fact that Reagan was one of these people who most promoted religion. He was one of the first presidents in recent times who promoted religion all over the place. Even though, like that senator in the Spartacus movie, privately, he was probably an agnostic, and we know Nancy Reagan believed in all this stuff with the horoscopes and all that kind of stuff. But publicly, he promoted religion on a big scale. And so it's important to talk about what was the morality of this man and what did he actually do in the world. And this little thing that tells a big story happened during the 1970s when Reagan was governor of California. And there was this group, the Symbionese Liberation Army. They weren't good. Their tactics and strategy were wrong. They did some bad things. But they kidnapped Patty Hearst at one time, who was the heir to the big Hearst family fortune. One of the demands they raised was that free food be given out to poor people all over California. So while they were holding Patty Hearst, the Hearst family agreed to distribute this food. They set up distribution points in different supermarkets and so on around the country. And in the midst of this, Ronald Reagan came forward and said, well, hopefully we can have an outbreak of botulism, of deadly food poisoning. Now, by what conceivable standard could you wish deadly food poisoning on thousands of poor people receiving food that they can't afford to pay for? Whatever you want to think about the Symbionese Liberation Army, on what possible basis could a decent person wish an outbreak of deadly food poisoning on people like that? And if they want to tell us that was a joke, what kind of person could think that's funny? Well, let me move on. Let's talk some more about oppressive relations that are upheld, and not just upheld, but commanded and celebrated in the Bible. Not just in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament as well. Slavery and other forms of ruthless exploitation. The oppression of women, even including the so-called right to carry them off as prizes of war, rape them and make them concubines or sex slaves of the conquerors. The condemnation of homosexuality as not just a sin, but an abomination deserving of death. The right and indeed the duty, as commanded by the Lord, to plunder and slaughter people following other religions and many other cruel and brutal forms of oppression. All of this is upheld in the Bible, and I'm going to talk about it more and more. If you don't believe me, go look up every citation I give you and go read the Bible, and you'll see it's all there. And the fact is, if you believe in the Bible, And especially if you believe and insist that it is the Word of God, and every word must be taken literally, then all these horrible things are things that you must say are right and good because the Bible says they are right and good. Now, in this talk, I'm focusing on Christianity and the Bible. But the same is true of Islam and the Quran. There, too, all kinds of oppressive relations are upheld and even celebrated. I won't have time tonight to go into all this, but I'll give you some examples or refer you to some places you can check into this. If you look at different surahs or chapters of the Quran, for example, the cow, you will see the inferior status of women and the oppression of women is upheld and insisted upon. Women are not as worth as much as men. The same in the surah actually called women. There, women and slavery are upheld. In the chapter Spoils of War, there's a discussion about women and other things taken as prizes of war when you slaughter and conquer your enemies. In the surah, the chapter the bee, slavery is upheld. In the surah, the believers, once again, the oppression of women and slavery upheld. In the surah Light, the oppression and inferior status of women is insisted upon. In the surah, the clan, once again, women and the oppression of women and slavery are upheld. In the surah, ornaments of gold, inequality in society and exploitation by one part of society over another is justified. In the surah, the mount, we are told about how women will be rewards for men in heaven. In the beneficent, the surah, the beneficent, we are more explicitly told that virgin women will be rewards for men in heaven. And I'm going to get back to this whole virgin thing as we go along. But right now, let's return to the Bible. And let's talk about the Old Testament and the New Testament and what is said in each of them. Because many people say, well, you know, there's all that, I agree there's all that bad stuff in the Old Testament, but the New Testament is different. That's the story of Jesus, and that Jesus is, after all, the Prince of Love. Well, let's talk about this straightforwardly. In a way, you could say that the essential message of the Christian religion is put forward in John 3:16. Now, some of you may be familiar with this, those of you who know the Bible, but others of you who just watch sporting events, especially football games, there's usually when they kick the extra point after a touchdown, there's usually some fool sitting behind there with a crazy wig on his head holding up a sign saying, John 3:16. So let's talk about John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him shall not perish, but shall have eternal life. Well, let's dig more deeply into this and what it is actually getting at and what it is actually putting forward. Let's go back to Genesis. Once again, the myth of the fall of mankind, and the treacherous role of women. And the view of the nature of humanity and the fate of humanity that is put forward in Genesis. Because it would not be necessary, according to the Bible, for God to make this great sacrifice if it weren't for the fact that human beings fucked up in the Garden of Eden, and in particular Eve seduced man, Adam, into doing the wrong thing and going against God's will. So the view right from the beginning, in this verse that puts forward how loving God is to humanity, right away we have this notion that humanity is all screwed up. That it's the very nature of humanity to do things wrong and to do horrors. And that mankind has a fallen nature that on its own it can never change or get away from. That's the first thing. But then the second thing, think about it. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Why a son? First of all, the idea is absurd. If you believe in God, God could have as many fucking sons as he wanted. So what's the point? What's the point of only begotten son? See, for human beings who live in a patriarchal, that is a male-dominated society, the idea of sacrificing your son is one of the greatest sacrifices you could make. Because it's a male-dominated society where men count for more than women. So, you know, fuck a daughter, you can give them away to be raped, and there's plenty of that in the Bible too, even in the story of Lot. But a son, that's a different matter. So once again, you get this patriarchal view that's coming from these human beings living in a patriarchal society, projecting this God into the heavens, who makes this great sacrifice of giving up his only begotten son. Son, underline. Not daughter. You see, you can't even think of it being in the Bible. For God so loved the world that he gave up his only begotten daughter. It doesn't ring true, does it? Because this is a reflection of human beings expressing the relations, the oppressive, male-dominated relations of the society in which they lived. And the greatest sacrifice that these human beings can think of is a man giving up his son. And this takes us back to the role of women in the fall of man. Once again, back to Genesis. And we see Paul's comment on this. For example, in 1 Timothy 11-15... where he repeats the idea of the curse on women because of what Eve did in the Garden of Eden. And then says, get this. Then says, this is a curse and they will have this curse in childbearing. But if they are obedient to their husbands and to men and they bear children, then they can somehow be redeemed from this curse upon them. So right there you see two things. Women are to be inferior to men and women's essential role is to churn out babies for men. And think of the influence of that down through the ages, right to today, and people you know right around you. Now let's go on and talk about the origin myth around Jesus. If you read the Bible and you start off with the first part of the New Testament, Matthew, it starts off with something very few people can follow, the begats. And so begat so-and-so begat so through 14 generations. And so begat so-and-so 14 generations. So-and-so to David the king. Blah, 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 blah. Down to Joseph, Jesus' father. Now, if you actually look at history and compare the record, it's not accurate. The 14 generations don't correspond to what you can actually learn from history about this genealogy that's being given there. But never mind that for now. But what goes along with this, note that in Luke chapter 3, verses 23-38, there's a different version of this. The genealogy, the lineage or family line of Jesus and his ancestors is different than in Matthew. Apparently the God who was supposed to have divinely inspired the Bible couldn't himself keep all this genealogy straight when dictating to those who supposedly wrote it down. But the more serious point is that these begats once again are all in the service of reinforcing male domination and patriarchy. As I pointed out in the booklet, Liberation Without Gods, the whole thing in Matthew is an attempt to trace Jesus' roots from Abraham, a patriarch, a ruler of the ancient Jewish people, according to the Bible, through King David, to Joseph, the father of Jesus, even though Joseph's seed had absolutely nothing to do with it. Think about it. A crucial part of the Christian mythology is that Jesus was born of what? A virgin, Mary. So what the fuck did Joseph have anything to do with? This is a history of patriarchs. An attempt to put Jesus squarely within the tradition of patriarchs and patriarchal kings and rulers of the Jewish people in ancient times. Even though Mary is Jesus' blessed mother, her seed, her lineage, does not count. Why? Because she's a woman. Her role is to be a martyr and a loving, long-suffering mother of Jesus. But when it comes to tracing the lineage from the ancient patriarchs of the Jewish people down to Jesus and to prove his right to be the Messiah, she doesn't figure into it at all. Joseph figures in, even though, according to the Bible, he had no part in all this. Here is another example of something that promotes patriarchy and the cruel oppression that has accompanied it for generations and centuries. This time from Jesus himself in the New Testament, in his own words. According to Jesus, getting a divorce and remarrying is committing adultery, is a sin. For example, you can see this in Luke 16, verse 18, and Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 and 32. Imagine, and unfortunately we do not have to imagine, all the suffering that this idea has served to reinforce and has caused down through the ages, especially for women who are trapped in marriages that are oppressive and abusive. The idea that if they leave an oppressive and abusive husband, that is a sin. A sin equal to adultery. Think of all the tremendous, horrific suffering This is caused and reinforced down through centuries and centuries and centuries. People having this preached at them by the religious authority, citing the Bible. Now I will return and go more fully into essential aspects of the Christian message and doctrine a little later. But first it's important to discuss the relation between the Christian religion and the Jewish religion, Judaism. That is to discuss Christianity as it first developed within and then as it separated itself from and increasingly came into hostile conflict with Judaism. And from there, the love-hate orientation and relationship that Christianity has had toward Judaism throughout the history of Christianity. Now, if you study the history of Christianity, shortly after Jesus died and was crucified, Paul began to emerge as a major leader. In fact, Paul is actually the dominant figure in the New Testament of the Bible, even more so than Jesus. It's Paul who sets the terms to a large degree for the New Testament. But Paul was not the only leader of the early Christian communities. There were at least two other major leaders for a while. Peter, who was one of Jesus' disciples, and James, who was Jesus' brother, according to the Bible. And a struggle developed among them after, you see, what they all expected that Jesus would be the triumphant Messiah. In the Jewish tradition, the Messiah was not supposed to be executed on the cross. He's supposed to be a conquering hero. That's why a lot of the Jewish people rejected Jesus the Messiah. What kind of fucking Messiah is this? He's supposed to lead us out of bondage and conquer our enemies, and look what happened to him. So the early Jewish community, the early Christian communities began to have struggle. Well, what do they do about this? They have to start inventing stories and myths to explain this away, to take this apparent defeat and turn it into a victory. Hence the story of the resurrection, for which, by the way, there's no evidence anywhere outside the Bible for anything like that. But as these struggles developed within the early Christian communities over what direction to take this religion that had been fractured because of the death of its leader, Jesus, they came against some really tough questions. And they had different positions, or as we say now, different lines on what to do about this. For example, Jesus' brother James was supposed to be the most traditionally Jewish. His position was to insist that they had to stay strictly within the Jewish tradition and recruit only among Jews. Peter had sort of a middle position. Well, we should still be based mainly among Jews, but we shouldn't exclude other peoples. But Paul said, hey, if we're going to really spread this religion, we have to go out among the Gentiles in a big way, because the Jews are rejecting this and we're going to die off if we don't get some new recruits out there. So you read Paul's letters and it's full of this kind of stuff about how they need to go to the Gentiles. And he carries on what we call polemics, arguments with the other people in the Christian leadership at that time. And this came up around a number of key issues. In particular, it came up around the commandments and requirements of the Old Testament. There are a lot of very strict dietary requirements in the Old Testament, in the Jewish religion, if you strictly adhere to it. They were having a lot of difficulty getting people to recruit to Christianity because a lot of people hadn't grown up with all those dietary restrictions and they didn't want to adopt them. So Paul said, well, you don't have to actually uphold the law to the letter. You just have to uphold the spirit of it. But the biggest question they faced was, since this religion was based among men primarily, and men were the dominant ones in the society and the dominant ones that they were seeking to recruit, the biggest hurdle they faced was circumcision. You see, Jewish children were circumcised early. Well, let's say you're a Gentile, and Paul comes to you and says, you're a Gentile man, Paul comes to you and says, convert to Christianity. They didn't have anesthesia. And all kinds of sophisticated instruments at that time. Getting circumcised as an adult was a big deal. And it was really holding back their recruitment. So Paul, if you read in the Bible, Paul says, you don't have to be circumcised in the flesh, you can be circumcised in the spirit. Well, that helped them a lot. And this is one of the reasons why Paul became the dominant figure, because he had his finger on the pulse of things more, if you'll pardon the expression. Now, there are humorous sides to this, but this is also very serious and deadly. Referring back to this movie, The Passion of the Christ, if you study, you know, even biblical scholars who are willing to think a little bit, You will discover that this whole story of how the Jews were the ones responsible for Jesus being crucified. Remember, Pontius Pilate washes his hands. The Roman rulers, well, I don't really see anything wrong with him. Why don't we just let him go? No, no, say all the Jewish mob there and the Jewish authorities. This is a very unlikely story that the Roman authorities would allow, when faced with a person who's accused of being a rebel and a troublemaker, that they would allow the Jewish mob to decide what to do about him. It's a very unlikely story. But it's a story that, as scholarship has shown, was worked into the Christian tradition about a century after the death of Jesus. Because by that time, Christianity, which had grown up as a sect within Judaism, was largely rejected by Jews, and had begun to become a separate religion, mainly recruiting Gentiles, non-Jews. And so it now found itself in very sharp conflict with Judaism. It was no longer one part of Judaism, but something growing out of it and sharply opposed to it. And as part of this, this story about how the Jews are responsible for the death of Christ and a curse, you know, Mel Gibson took this particular part out of the movie, but left in the references to it, where one of the Jewish leaders says a curse will be upon our generations for what we have done here in bringing about the crucifixion of Jesus. And this has had horrific consequences for the Jewish people down through the centuries, where this biblical passage that was put in there to blame the Jews for the death of Jesus has been used as justification for all kind of brutality, murder, segregation, discrimination, and all kinds of horrors perpetrated against the Jewish people ever since. Especially once Christianity became a powerful religious institution and then got the force of the Roman Empire behind it. So there's this kind of contradiction that Christianity cannot remove itself from its foundation of Judaism. If they took out the Old Testament, then there would be no basis for saying Jesus is the Messiah and the whole thing would fall to the ground. So they have to leave in the New Testament. They can't remove themselves from that foundation. But at the same time, Christianity increasingly developed in opposition and in hostile conflict with Judaism. And as Christianity grew into a religion separate from Judaism, this antagonism not only grew more intense, but it took on a different and more ominous and dangerous and deadly expression. As Christianity became, from the 4th century on, the official religion of the Roman Empire, and then the official or all but official religion of other empires and oppressive systems down through the century, Christian zealots, but also the Christian church itself, have encouraged and played an active part in segregating and discriminating against Jews, condemning them in the most vile terms, and encouraging and organizing pogroms, that is, campaigns of violence and mass murder against Jewish people. And this is not simply a thing of the past. It has persisted down to the present age, and these ideas continue to find expression even today in things like Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, where the Jews are associated with the devil, not very subtly. And this movie, The Passion of Christ, is not just a particular personal passion or project of Mel Gibson. This was strongly supported, directly or indirectly, overtly, openly and aggressively, or more subtly and sneakily by everybody from the Pope to Protestant Christian fundamentalists like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and others with connections right up to the highest levels of the American government. And this is very interesting. At the same time as all this anti-Semitism and other oppressive things are being promoted by these people, these reactionary Christian fundamentalists, and more importantly, the reactionary Christian fundamentalist president and his administration, at the same time as they do this, they provide the most uncritical and unflinching support and backing to the state of Israel, a Jewish state, and support and back and finance and arm them in all the many ways in which Israel has not only robbed the Palestinian people of their homeland and continues to viciously oppress them, but also the ways in which Israel serves as a military outpost and instrument of U.S. imperialism in the world, not only in the strategic region of the Middle East, but even in far-flung parts of the globe, such as Latin America and East Asia, where Israel does dirty work for U.S. imperialism, much of which is exposed in our newspaper, The Revolutionary Worker. But they have a contradiction, these rulers of the U.S. nowadays. On the one hand, they're linked up with all these religious fundamentalists who go around promoting the Jews as the Christ killers. There was this article in the New York Times Magazine about how this fool from the Florida State, Charlie Ward, played for the New York Knicks, was promoting all this religious fundamentalist nonsense. He was so stupid, he did it while talking to a Jewish reporter from the New York Times. And Alan Houston was backing him up, and at a certain point, Alan Houston went into his Palm Pilot and quoted Matthew. See, right here it says the Jews are the Christ killers. So you've got all these people trained and indoctrinated in this kind of foolishness, and worse than foolishness. At the same time, you're telling them they have to support Israel blindly and unquestioningly. Well, that's a contradiction. How do you get around it? Well, here's how they go around it. As I pointed out in this article I wrote for our newspaper called, well, it's actually on the DVD too, is a response to a question on the DVD that is here for sale, about what we call the pyramid of power. And what do? Well, they say, okay, here's why we have to support Israel, all you Christian fundamentalists. According to our interpretation of the book of Revelation, the second coming and the return of Jesus and all that cannot happen unless the state of Israel first exists. So if the state of Israel is destroyed, then the second coming will be greatly set back and the forces of the Antichrist will greatly benefit. Therefore, we have to support Israel. And they have cultivated a group of people whose sort of reason for existing as a political force is refusing to think. People who will blindly follow whatever they're told the Bible tells them is the truth. You can turn on the cable access and see them, you know, from beginning of the day to the end. And unfortunately, while it's funny, it's also not funny because a lot of pressed people are caught up in this bullshit. And this is how they get them to support Israel while hanging on to the idea of the Jews as the Christ killers. And in all this, it's very important to keep in mind that in the worldview of these Christian fundamentalists, the choice for the Jews, when the second coming actually comes about, according to them, the choice for the Jews will be to convert to Christianity, all of them, or be condemned to eternal damnation. So we can see, if we look at history, and it's worth stepping back and looking at it a little bit more, that from the time Christianity became the favored and then the official religion of the rulers of the Roman Empire, it has ruthlessly persecuted not only the Jews, but anybody who attempted to practice any other religion. You know, in our society, all we ever hear about is how the Christians were persecuted under the Roman Empire. And yes, there was some persecution, particularly under emperors like Nero in the early days of Christianity. But that was off and on. And the reason the Christians ran into trouble with the Roman Empire was not because people wouldn't let them practice another religion. In the pagan religion that was dominant in the Roman Empire at that time, you could believe in any god you wanted. There were plenty of gods. The Romans had many gods. They believed in Apollo, the sun god, Diana, the moon goddess, all kinds of different gods, and they referred to different parts of nature. So the Christians wanted to have another god? Sure, come on in. We got plenty of room. The reason the Christians ran into trouble was because at the same time as you worship these pagan gods, as they were called, or now called by Christians, you had to not only swear allegiance to the emperor, but you had to recognize some divinity to the emperor. And all these other religions would say, sure, fine, you know, we got Apollo and Diana, why not Caesar? But the Christians said, no, there's only one divinity, and that's, you know, the Trinity, where they later came up with, or God and Jesus. That's the only divinity. So that's where they ran into trouble. They refused to recognize any divinity of the emperor. But this went on off and on over a few centuries. And, you know, one of the things these Christian fundamentalists these days, they like to act like they're the Christians back in the Roman Colosseum. Oh, we're always persecuted, you know. We can't force our religious fundamentalism down everybody's throat, so we're victims here. And they always like to point back to the days of the Roman Empire. See, we're just like the poor. Their fucking religion is running the fucking world. Being used as an ideological instrument to reinforce oppression and exploitation of the most cruel and barbarous kind, and they're trying to pose as victims. Because they can't go around openly having prayers in the public schools. But even in the Roman Empire, in the 4th century, Constantine was fighting a rival German commander in general named Maxentius to see who would become the dominant ruler over all the Roman Empire. And right before a key battle against Maxentius, Constantine, according to the story that he and his mother recreated later, awakened in the middle of the night to see a blazing cross lighting up the sky, and with it the words, "By this sign ye shall conquer." And under this banner, supposedly, he took his troops into battle against Maxentius and defeated him, became the ruler of Rome, and from there he adopted Christianity as the religion of the Roman Empire. It was Constantine, in the 300s, who drew all these religious authorities together and forced them to hammer out a lot of the stuff that's now in the Bible, including the impossible idea of the Trinity, which, believe me, nobody understands. And after that, although there was a little back and forth, there were a few pagan emperors after that, very soon, by the next century, the 5th century, the 400s, Christianity had become the dominant religion of the Roman Empire, and from that point on, it went about brutally persecuting and killing people who tried to practice another religion. So we could say that Christianity, once it became the official religion, was much more extreme and did much greater harm in suppressing other religions than was ever done to Christianity itself. I don't have time to go on to all this. There are books like James Carroll's Constantine Swords. There's the classical historical work by Edward Gibbon, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which go into this much more fully. But once again, the important point here is, for all those who refuse to practice Christianity or who are declared to be enemies of Christianity, down through the centuries since then, whether the people in the Crusades, both the Jews as well as the Muslims, or people who were victimized by the Christian Inquisition, where they tortured people who refused to convert to Christianity, and down to the present time throughout the world, wherever Christianity has been, as it was in the Roman Empire, the official or the all but official religion, people who have attempted to practice other religions have been discriminated against and brutally persecuted. Now this brings me to what I call, what our party calls, the Christian fascists in the U.S. Why do we call them that? Well, the simple reason is they're Christians and they're fascists. They are like our version of the Nazis in Germany. So let's talk about what traditions and traditional morality they insist on and want to force on all of society. What is this actually all about and what does it really represent? Now here comes a question. Have you ever noticed that what's called the Bible Belt in the U.S., the place where it's traditionally been the heartland of this fundamentalist religion, have you ever noticed that the Bible Belt is also the lynching belt? This is the area where historically in this country the most brutal oppression, including lynching of black people, has been carried out, and it has been justified over and over again in the name of the Bible. There's a story of Noah's son, Ham, who according to Genesis did something wrong and was cast as a curse into Africa. And that was used as a justification throughout the history of slavery in the U.S. for why slavery against Africans was justified. But beyond that, in this society, in America, with its whole history of oppression of black people, slavery, and all the oppression afterward, upholding tradition and traditional morality and insisting on unthinking obedience to authority go hand in hand with white supremacy as well as male supremacy. And it's not accidental that the Bible Belt has always been the lynching belt. Well, let's talk more about these Christian fascists. Let's get more concretely into examples of things that are advocated, indeed insisted upon, commanded, and even celebrated in the Old Testament to begin with. In particular, the first five books, the so-called Mosaic books, supposedly written by Moses in the Old Testament. What are these things that are upheld? Well, among them are slavery, rape and slaughter and plunder of people with different religions who happen to be on the land that the Lord had supposedly promised to Moses' people, and on and on and on. And I'm going to get into some of this. It's very gruesome and grotesque what's in the Bible. One of the things that I've observed is people, especially people who are blindly religious and believe in the Bible absolutely, don't even really understand what they're reading in the Bible. They just are told what to think and they go along with it without even looking at the words that are in the Bible itself. So I'm going to quote some of the words from the Bible. First, from the book of Numbers. This is one of the five Mosaic books. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The book of Numbers. There's a story of the battle of Moses and the Israelites against the Midianites. Moses and the Lord, according to the Bible, were furious with the Midianites and with many of the Jewish people because they were sleeping with the women of Midian. And guess what happened? Those sneaky, seductive women were getting them to worship their gods instead of the one true God. So the Lord told Moses, and Moses commanded the people, go out and slaughter the Midianites. And so they did. You can read this in Numbers 31, verses 13 to 18 and 31 to 35. Especially I'm going to focus on verses 17 to 18. Go out and slaughter the Midianites, they were told. So then the leaders of the army went out and slaughtered the Midianites. And then they came back and they reported to Moses what they'd done. And Moses got really angry. Did he get angry because they slaughtered the Midianites? No. He got angry because they were too fucking lenient. They only killed off the adult males and took some of their cattle and other things. And Moses said, God damn it, you... Well, he may not have said that, but you go back there. You go back there and you not only kill every adult male who might have escaped, you kill every female who is not a virgin and every male child among the Midianites. And those women who are virgins, you may take as prizes of the war. If you don't believe me, read it. In fact, I'm going to read it. Numbers 31, verses 17 and 18. So the Lord said, now therefore kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known a man by sleeping with him. But all the young girls who have not known a man by sleeping with him, keep alive for yourselves. Now this is the Lord speaking through Moses and to Moses. Well, what about Joshua and the Battle of Jericho? We've all heard about Joshua and the Battle of Jericho. There's even spirituals been written. Joshua with the Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua with the Battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. But what we're never told very often is what happened after the walls came tumbling down. According once again to the commandment of the Lord and Moses, they went in and slaughtered everybody. If you look, for example, at Joshua chapter 6, verses 17 to 19, and then especially verse 21, here's what it says. After the walls came tumbling down, then they devoted to destruction, which is a roundabout way of saying they slaughtered and destroyed. They devoted to destruction by the edge of the sword, all in the city of Jericho, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkeys. So the little children did not escape the justice of this God and his messenger, Joshua. Or if you go and read through the book of Isaiah, which is supposed to be one of Jesus' favorite books from the Old Testament, particularly chapters 12 to 14, you will see it goes on and on and on about the revenge that is going to be taken on Babylon and other peoples who are opposed to and practice different religions than the Israelites. Once again, the women are going to be raped, the babies are going to have their heads bashed in, and all the men are going to be slaughtered. Over and over and over again, this is proclaimed, sung about in hymns almost by the prophet Isaiah. Well, we always hear about the Psalms and how they are expressions of God's love and so on, mercy. Well, let's look at Psalm 137. There was actually a reggae song, some of you may know, that was based on this. By the rivers of Babylon, where we sat down, and there we wept, when we remembered Zion. Well, those are the first verses of Psalm 137. You know what the last verses are? Here's verses 8 and 9, which conclude that psalm. O daughter Babylon, you devastator, Happy shall be they who pay you back what you have done to us. Happy shall be they who take your little ones and dash them against the rock. Now, if you accept what the Bible says, God is no better than Dracula. The only problem is he's more powerful than Dracula. Now, as some of you may know, the figure in the movies and literature of Dracula was based on an historical figure, a Romanian historical figure named Vlad. It was called Vlad the Impaler. And to his enemies, like the people from Turkey who practiced Islam, as well as the peasants who rose up against his rule in Romania several centuries ago, his favorite form of punishment, and the way he got his name, was he would impale them. He would drive stakes through their body and let them sit out rotting until they died. That's what it means to impale somebody. So that's the basis for the character Dracula. It was the historical figure of Romania, Vlad the Impaler. Well, in the Bible, not only does Moses, acting on the Lord's behalf, kill thousands of his own people, of the Israelites, because they worshipped an idol, but when the Lord learns that the men of Israel, here we go again, are having sexual relations with the women of Moab, and are being seduced by these women into worshiping their gods instead of the one true God, then the Lord orders Moses to, quote, take all the chiefs of the people of Israel and impale them in the desert sun. This is once again from the book of Numbers, chapter 25, verses 1 to 5. Now, these are not isolated incidents. The famous isolated incidents. According to the Bible itself, if you read it and you understand what you're reading, this kind of slaughter, pillage, and rape was carried out over and over again in accordance with the commandments of the Lord. And these parts of the Bible, the Mosaic books in particular, are full of instructions from the Lord and his representatives and spokesmen like Moses and also Joshua, insisting that they carry out this pillage, rape, and slaughter, including the mass murder of babies and infants. That they carry it out thoroughly and without mercy. And when you see all these zombies out here at abortion clinics talking about baby killers, distorting what actually happens in an abortion when most abortions, more than 90%, take place during the first 3 months of pregnancy, when the fetus is only as big as the period at the end of a sentence and is not a highly developed being capable of independent life on its own, as they always parade around with these signs as if, you know, grown babies are being killed. But what hypocrisy! These are people out there mumbling their verses from the Bible, the very Bible which calls over and over again for slaughtering babies and infants. This should be presented to them and they should be challenged with this. Who really believes in things that call for slaughtering babies and infants if you insist the Bible is true in every word and must be upheld to the letter? Or let's talk about the Ten Commandments. There's been a lot of talk about the Ten Commandments. It's been in the news because that fool down in Alabama, that judge, insisted on putting up the monument, wouldn't take it down. He's worse than a fool.